Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Dangerous Supertone Show.
Heartbreak Hotel by John Cale from Slow Dazzle, which is his fifth studio album released in March 1975 and his second release with Island Records.
Produced at Sound Technique Studios, recorded at under the auspices of John Wood. Now, we seem to be moving out of Sound Techniques and studios now, don't we? It's a different, you know, because we've been Olympic. Now we see there's a few, because last week we had Nick Drake on. But they used to do an awful lot of folk there. And there must be a reason why John Cale recorded there.
I don't know. I'll tell you what I did get confused about, is that I thought John Cale was JJ Cale. No, seriously. You might think this just comes naturally because, you know, you know these guys. I don't. I thought that JJ Cale was the same guy. I didn't know there was a guy separate, John Cale, and I did not know that he was at the Velvet Underground. And it's really weird. I just have a major gap. I know Lou Reed, but I didn't know, because I really don't know people's names. Why should I know? I'm into the music, not where they buy their underpants from.
Underpants is a very strange expression for the Americans.
Oh, what do we say then? Knickers.
I don't know what the actually said, but I remember saying underpants to somebody in New York when I first went over there, and they burst out laughing. They couldn't believe what it was. underpants? I said, yes, underpants.
Well, if you say thongs, apparently, that means flip-flops in Australia. So we really are in a bit of a complete twizzle now, haven't we? Got a knickers in a twist.
Well, talk to me about Don John Cale.
Don? He could well be, actually. He's a bit of a dark figure, isn't he, John Cale? When you look right. So John Cale, if you don't know, like I didn't know, he's a bassist, a viola player, a keyboardist, and occasional songwriter. He worked with, obviously, he was a founding member of the Velvet Underground and as a producer, and had his very own large discography of solo stuff as well. But the thing with him is that he was caught between the tracks. Cracks, same kind of thing, I guess. He was too weird for commercial success, and yet not really weird or daring enough to place him among the top ranks of sort of rock innovation. So that's him in a nutshell. So going back to where we're talking about studios now, then, now that I kind of know this chap, he exists and he's in this place.
Well, when he visited the UK in 65, he sort of had a crude acoustic demo of the Velvet Underground, which he tried to record to get a record deal. And he played it to Marianne Faithfull and Joe Boyd. Now, Joe Boyd was the producer who worked with Nick Drake later on from Sound Technique Studios, and that's why I think the connections come. Yeah, and as soon as he played it to them, they got connected with Bowie and the Yardbirds, and it was a band called the Deviants actually came out of that. But anyway, Velvet Underground became to great success, of course, yeah, or not so anti-success, because apparently they weren't commercially successful, but they sparked off thousands of bands all over the world. We've talked about this, I think, before, yeah, in one of the previous shows, you know.
Yeah, well, how does that happen?
Well, it was so cool.
It was, I just found that really fascinating, you know.
Yeah. I mean, like Devo. I mean, Devo were actually pretty big, but when they kicked off, I mean, a lot of people, again, Bowie, you know, you listen to what was going on and Brian Eno, and they thought, wow, this is something really cool and different, you know. So it's quite fascinating, really.
And what a classic of a song to cover. It's so dark, Heartbreak Hotel, in a way that I've never heard it before. I love it.
Well, I bought a compilation album around about 77, and the only reason I bought it, and I knew John Cale was obviously from the Velvet Underground, but I'd never seen him do any solo stuff, and it had a flying V on the front,
right.
And I thought, wow, this is going to be really cool. And then the first track on that album is Heartbreak Hotel, and I thought, holy shit, that's amazing, because what a fantastic groove, and I think, and a great guitar line, and I think Chris Spedding played that, session guitar player, he actually played on this record, and it just sounds remarkable, you know, to me.
And what's really interesting about that, I totally get where you're coming from, but that was written, that song, by Tommy Durden and May Boren Axton, who was the Queen Mother of Nashville, apparently.
Yeah.
And here's a lovely bit of trivia for you, that it was Boren who actually introduced a 19-year-old Elvis Presley to Colonel Tom Parker.
No.
Oh, yeah. She'd seen him perform in Jacksonville, Florida, and she was actually pressing RCA to actually sign Elvis.
Absolutely incredible.
Isn't that great? So that song has got so much power to it. It's so much connection to Elvis and to his career. And then you've got John Cale doing this incredible version of it as well.
Yeah, very dark. I mean, it became a centrepiece of his live performance. But I just looked it up, actually, and Phil Manzanera's on that as well. Chris Spedding on guitar and Brian Eno.
Yeah.
Magma.
Hot.
Kabaya. The opening track from their debut album, Magma, surprisingly enough, released as a double LP in 1970 on Philips record label. Written, in most part, by Christian Vander, who was a classically trained drummer.
Now, what is going on there? Can I just say, right, that maybe a couple of years ago, my head would have been completely fried by listening to that. But because I now know Hocus Pocus Focus by Focus, and I've listened to Javi Vercher and Jordi Rossi, who were Spanish jazz, world-class jazz...
musicians, yeah.
Well, I don't even... They're musicians, but they're genius, yeah, aren't they? They're both amazing. I now...
Well, they recorded it.
I can handle it.
They did a few recordings at our studio.
I know.
We mixed the album, didn't we? Which was so wild.
It was mad. It was just evocative of so many pictures, wasn't it?
And I had a terrible problem with his marimbas. Jorge's marimbas. Anyway, let's not worry about Jorge's marimbas.
So let's make some sense of all this. Okay, so we're talking about Javier Vercher, who's a world-class saxophone player, yeah, and Jordi Rossi, who's like one of the world's best jazz drummers. Yeah. And they came to our studio.
Stands in for Brian Blade occasionally.
Indeed. Stuff, yeah. And then we recorded them in our Supertone studio in Valencia. So we've got that experience in our head. And then we listen. And obviously we've got the Hocus Focus Pocus on the other side. I know I mixed that up. And then you've got this band, Magma, French progressive rock band from Paris.
Well, they were so powerful and so sort of influential, they actually had their own style of music labelled after them called Zool, which is actually from the language that they created to produce their music, because they had a right problem with what was happening in the world at the moment, you know, nothing new there, and he decided to create this new language and write the whole record and all his subsequent records in this new language. And I remember, the reason why I bought this album was I remember reading about him in Melody Maker, and I thought, new language, you know, going to a different planet, this is cool, we like this. But they were really so far into it, you know, they were actually speaking it like in interviews and stuff, which
no.
is, oh yeah, oh my goodness me, they caused tremendous amounts of bother. Julian Vander, he was known as a complete a complete lunatic, but he wasn't a lunatic. I think he was probably highly drug inspired and you know, SD and all that, but he did have an amazing imagination and also an amazing amount of creativity, and I love that record. Even listening back to it for a long time, I haven't heard it, but it sounds great.
Well, what do you say to that? So Zool, yeah, they're saying it's like a jazz fusion symphonic rock, and it's like what you'd expect an alien rock opera to sound like, with chanted choral motifs, sudden bursts of explosive improvisation. So I love the way people try and put these into words. I know it. They were saying it's like this mix of Germanic and Slavonic.
Yeah.
Sounds, and that got me thinking. Now I don't know anything about that interview, and I'm talking about this, but you know when I say to you sometimes I like my favourite words in German are like phrases. I go, "Du bist ein Feuerzeug," and it sounds completely different. It means you're a lighter, but it sounds like I'm swearing at you. And I get where he's coming from. It's like, you know, and my favourite German word is Schnurrbart, which is moustache. Schnurrbart.
It's a great word.
See, so from a sonic point of view, a phonetic kind of a feel from words, I really kind of get why where he started from, because it evokes different things to what they actually mean.
Yeah, and I think the whole thing is the sound as well. I mean, it's clearly influenced by John Coltrane, you know, that sort of very, you know, and actually the sounds of that album, they sound great to me. I know it was done in the 70s, so we love that sort of sound. But the bass as well, it had that real grunt to it, and some really nice playing on there, you know. Did he get married to the singer or something, or wasn't he?
I think his partner was actually one of the singers.
Yeah.
Yeah, Stella. That's it. And then they had singer Klaus Blaskowitz and fusion bassist Francis Mose and Yannick Topp.
Blimey.
Great names, aren't they?
Absolutely.
But I love the whole thing. Do you know what it makes me want to do? And I almost think it's sort of, there's kind of an ethnicity about it, which I like as well. It makes me feel like I can improvise, you know, because sometimes I always laugh when I hear men going, ooh, because it's, you know, can you imagine that big rock guys?
Beach Boys album.
Metal. And these guys are going, la, 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 ooh. And it's just so funny. It is.
Especially the big hairy ones, yeah. We'll be right back.
Mr. David Gilmour. A song called Cry From The Street from his debut studio solo album released on the 25th of May on the Harvest label in the UK and the 17th of June on the Columbia label in the USA, and that's in 1978. And it went to number 17 in the UK album charts and number 29 on the Billboard US album charts. There you have it.
Bearing in mind this is sort of 12, 18 months after punk started, so it's really still of a progressive sort of sound thing going on, but that riff at the beginning, ba-da-ba, and it's the space he leaves, ba-da-da, ba-da-ba, and it stops, ba-da-da, and then he pulls down. You need to listen to it again, rewind it, listen to it again, and it comes doo-ba-doo, and that twang of the strat, it goes dong. You can just hear the string going doing without any distortion on it. Absolutely beautiful feel. Great. I love that end bit. Great solo. The only disappointing thing about that is that like sort of chord sequence. It's sort of, it's very Floyd-ed. Sort of very Floyd-ed. I haven't said that. It was in
Pink Floyd. I was going to say he was probably the primary one of, yeah, went off anyway.
But it's a interesting sort of song. And his voice sounds a bit ropey on that, to tell you the truth. But, you know, I think he was just sort of starting out on his solo thing. And of course, later on, he sings now in Pink Floyd all the time.
I mean, how do you actually do that, being a big supergroup and then go solo after? I mean, I know there was a disagreement, wasn't it? I think it was... what's interesting when you look at the beginning of all this is that Dave actually met Syd Barrett years ago, didn't he? Before he was in Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
So they were mates before. And then it was Syd that was in a band with Roger Waters and that lot. And Dave Gilmour joined Pink Floyd to help out Syd, wasn't it? Because he wasn't coping very well. And he came in to sort of support the band. And then Syd left and he took over. So you've got him coming into this band after it was kind of originally formed and then completely taking it fusion-wise with Roger Waters to a new direction. And it grew magnificently, didn't it?
Yeah.
And then there's talk of the fact that he wanted to do more stuff and Roger wanted it his way, and then you leave, don't you?
It became more Roger Waters, didn't it?
Yeah, I get that. So this is him going, I need to be me.
Mm. Well, it's an interesting album. I mean, it's not his best solo album, I don't think, but I played it because, as I said, in this show that we play everything that's in our vinyl collections, don't we? So we have a look around and we choose stuff. Yeah. So it was there, and this track's always been there, but, you know, and it just shows him starting off in this whole thing. But his guitar playing is still magnificent. His guitar sound is still great. A bit edgy and a bit grittier than in Pink Floyd, actually, and less subtle. But, you know, and he produces as well, didn't he?
He did. It was recorded in, I love the name of this, Super Bear Studios in France. I need to say that in a French accent, really, as opposed to American.
Super Bear Studios are.
I don't know either. But what, do you know what I think as well? I think, you know, when I what I was really struck by as well is when you hear Dave talk, and he's got a really nice RP sort of accent, hasn't he? And his father was a teacher of zoology. Which is a lecturer in zoology at Cambridge.
Right, okay.
So this is quite interesting. And also, the other thing that I know about Dave is that I'm not really into electric guitar solos that much, just because I don't often think they say something. But, you know, we were just talking about Magma and the sounds and the language. Now, for me, I think Dave Gilmour has a language in his guitar. He's one of the few guitarists. You have a language when you play.
Thank you.
But also Dave Gilmour does. I can hear, I can imagine him saying something to me, and they're not words, but I feel that he's saying something.
Well, he does. He speaks with his guitar. And you know, his solo, some of the greatest electric guitar ever recorded, I think, you know.
Yeah, he's magnificent, actually.
You know, he really is fantastic. I've done a quick look, actually, at Super Bear Studios, and it was... French studio and an MCI console in there, but used by a lot of the superstars in the foothills of the Alps, and the Police recorded there, and Kate Bush, and lots of other people. Yeah,
well, that's interesting, because didn't Dave actually, he co-produced Kate Bush's debut album, The Kick Inside.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
Didn't he discover her? I think he did.
I did not do this. Is this true? C'est vrai? Magnifique! Sacré bleu!
This French has got to stop. It's got to stop.
Got it.
Yeah. But so anyway, Dave Gilmour, Cry from the Street. Great song.
Oh yeah, you're listening to The Supertone Show with Susie Starlight and like Simon Campbell from the Starlight Campbell Band.
What was that like?
I don't know.
I think we're trying to get some meters grooving there, and that indeed was the meters. Sissy Strut, 1969 funk instrumental, released as a single from the debut and eponymous studio album, The Meters, on the Hosey label. Jose?
Josie?
I don't know. Whatever label it was, but it was on a label.
Let's talk about The Meters.
Let's talk about
them. They're legends. Why are they legends? What is it about The Meters?
It's the groove. I mean, that drumming is sloppy, sort of slinky, like groove. And I've never heard so much sizzling hi-hat. The hi-hat's mixed ridiculously high. It's... but you know, he's got great high work and very, very groovy, you know. And the bass, Art Neville, of course, on Hammond there, one of the mighty Neville brothers. And we're going to be playing some tracks over the next few weeks. The Neville brothers,
I love the Neville brothers,
yeah. You know,
they're legends.
Well, they are, they're great. And the work that Daniel Lanois did with them, certainly on Yellow Moon. Just an incredible album. Unfortunately, well, or fortunately, it's not actually on Spotify. You can't find it anywhere.
No.
So we've got a vinyl copy. And fortunately, I do have a CD as well, so we're going to have to use that to play these.
I know.
Yeah. Anyway, back to The Meters.
I remember when I learned Sissy Strut a couple of years ago, and we remember we went out to this kind of jazz jam night.
Yeah.
And it was just, oh, I struggle. It's weird, you know. And what was the best, every time I hear this song, and we both giggle about this, right, there's this guy, you've got to check him out on YouTube, called Kid Anderson. And he tells you, he goes, the things that people do wrong, they play wrong on Sissy Strut. And his little strapline is, don't be a lame, play it right, the cool way. So he'll go, da-da-da-doom-doom, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da- You've got to watch him, honestly, because we play it over and over just to watch him because we giggle so much.
We were crying laughing.
Oh, he's great.
Because when he goes wrong, because everybody plays the wrong note, and actually it should be the five. It's the five note of the chord.
That's
right. And people play, I can't remember what other note it is. It's bass, of course. I don't take much notice of it, really. But
yeah, right.
Ooh. But yeah, but it's hilarious. And streams of tears because he jumps into the camera and goes wrong.
And you so remember it. It's like, anyway, so check out Kid Anderson. But in terms of the meters, right, so if you were going to define them, because I know their feel and I know their style, but what they say and what they write about them is that they defined New Orleans funk, not only on their own recordings, but also as the backing band for numerous artists, including many produced by Alan Toussaint or Toussaint. So you've got that kind of where the funk of Sly Stallone and James Brown was wild and careering and determinedly urban. The Meters were kind of different in down home and earthy feel.
Yeah.
And that kind of helps me understand in words, because a lot of the time I don't have words to paint onto the feel of the music.
Yeah, and well, you're right. And the guitar, I mean, it's very Steve Cropper. It's got a very clean sort of sound, Telecaster thing going on. I think it sounds like Telecaster. But it's a really cool, sloppy groove, but it really works and very, very danceable, isn't it?
It is. And I've got to tell you the band names, okay? So they were formed in 1965. So on drums, you've got Zigaboo Modeliste, or Ziggy. You've got George Porter Jr. on bass.
Yes,
dude.
King.
Leo Nocentelli on guitar and Art Neville on keyboards and later Cyril Neville. I love the name Cyril. One of my best friends is called Cyril, on percussion. So that song as well was inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame in 2011, and it was which honoured like recordings of lasting historical significance like over 25 years ago. And I will finish on this one bit because they were saying, you know, Ziggy's drumming. The secret is was saying that it's almost as if the drums are the lead.
Close the door, put out the light. No, they won't be home tonight. The snow falls hard, and don't you know? The winds of Thor are blowing cold. They're wearing steel that's bright and true.
Oh,
Well, I don't need to tell you who that is. Led Zeppelin, of course, and No Quarter from their fifth studio album, Houses of the Holy. And that was released on the 28th of March, way back when in 1973 on Atlantic Records.
Again in Atlantic, you know. Well, I think it's one of my favourite Zeppelin albums. I mean, I like them all, but my least favourite actually is Led Zeppelin 4, which everybody sort of raves about, you know, like one. But this is, it's an amazing song because the atmosphere it creates is tremendous. And I think it's, after Since I've Been Loving You, I think it's Jimmy Page's best guitar solo, in my opinion. I think that lovely, clean thing in the middle, that great break he does, is just marvellous. The drumming is, of course, John Bonham, but it's exceptional. It's fills, his sound, brilliant. The keyboards, of course, and bass with John Paul Jones, amazing. It was a synth bass on that, or not synth bass. I think it was probably I think there is a bit of synth in there, but
yeah.
it's certainly the Rhodes keyboard, the bass keyboard on his left hand that he's using, and I think also he's using a Maestro phaser on that as well. One of the first phasers that was created. I know you love all this stuff, you marvel at all this stuff that, yeah, but it is, I marvel at it, but it was one of the first phasers in it, and that's what's got that very, you know, whoing sound going on. Really great.
It felt, you know, when I really just closed my eyes and listened to that song, I actually really love it. It's odd.
Yeah.
But I felt like I was being drenched in fresh waterfall rain. It felt light and there was a lot of space in it. And there was like, you know, that synth sound. It was like, you know, there's like dragonflies floating around because you've got this kind of coarse texture from the synths coming in.
Yeah.
And then you've got this echo of plant, and you can probably see him with his loincloth up on the rocks there, you know, sort of like just like bathing in the sunshine, diving off and with his long flowing locks and stuff.
Well, this is on the Songwriter's Sam, of course, in the song. I can't remember which, because they did this very strange and indulgent scenes in between.
Yeah.
I think this is one of them. I think this could have been his. Anyway, I can't remember.
But it's quite evocative of images, that soundscape of that song. I really like it. And I love the space when the piano comes in as well. It's just really, it's quite magnificent,
it
actually.
Is, yeah. And recorded, again, at a combination of places between Stargrove, which is Mick Jagger's pad, wasn't it?
Stargrove. Sounds almost like a Muppet character.
And Hedley Grange.
Yeah.
And Island Studios, I think they mixed it, but he was using the Rolling Stones mobile with that marvellous Helios console in there again. And, you know, every time I hear records done with that Helios console, it just makes me weep with joy. It does, because it just sounds so beautiful, and the Helios compressors, you can just hear it. It's just amazing. But not engineered by Andy Johns this time, because Andy Johns did a lot of their earlier stuff, of course. Glyn Johns did the first record.
Yeah.
But this is engineered by Keith Harwood. And we mentioned Keith a couple of weeks ago because he was the guy that got killed in a motor car accident.
Not the
on
tree.
The same tree.
No.
Yeah. Yeah.
It
yeah.
is. It's a, oh, no. You brought it up again.
Yeah.
It's just, what's really interesting about that song, though, and you're talking about timing, because it fascinates me the way the market works with timing, when a song can be re-released and it's a hit and it's a flop the first time around. And the same with this song is that they previously tried to work on this song for their fourth album and it didn't actually come together. So John Paul Jones reworked the track and added the acoustic electric piano and some synths, and it got onto this album. See, so, and we have songs the same where we have them on back burners, don't we? We know there's something there, but the timing's not right. Doesn't it feel quite, it doesn't come to the front and say,
we've
I'm ready.
We've got two albums that are not particularly in a blues style, which we're not going to talk to you about.
Oh, no, we have.
In the can, yeah.
We have already.
We haven't recorded them yet, but we've actually written them all. So we've got two full albums that we haven't actually released yet.
Oh, yeah, they're there.
And we're working on the next one at the moment, Language of Curiosity. We're virtually through on that one, so that's
very
be
exciting.
Starting to be recorded next year, hopefully. But Eddie Kramer also engineered on that as well, which is also interesting, of course. The Tony Visconti, I'm reading his book at the moment. He hasn't got a lot of truck with Eddie Kramer. He don't particularly like him. He said he was a bit of an ass.
Oh.
So they are. And of course, he was Hendrix's engineer. But Visconti discounted completely the Hendrix albums. He said he didn't like them, so he thought the sound after seeing him live is far more forceful and the studio albums are very weak, which actually I agree with. Anyway, that's another story.
If you don't shut down real soon, you'll find yourself out on the street looking for another room. You see me on the corner having myself a ball. Don't change my way of living, and you won't know me alone. I can't let you do it. I can't let you do it to me. I know you're gonna do it, but I can't let you do it to me.
That was JJ Cale, Can't Let You Do It. Oh, sorry, Eric Clapton, Can't Let You Do It. JJ Cale wrote it, but I've never heard something that sounds more like JJ Cale than JJ Cale. Yeah. Unbelievable. But it was Eric Clapton off his last album, I Still Do, produced by the marvellous and wonderful and sexy and extremely talented Glyn Johns.
Let's do that together. Glyn Johns!
Who'd worked on Slowhand, of course, in 1977 and... Backless in 1978, and recorded at British Grove Studios. Now, before I talk about anything else, I just want to quickly talk about British Grove. Of course, Mark Knopfler's studio with a monstrously beautiful and sexy and to die for API console in there. A monster. It's the Legend Plus. It's just incredible. And that is a beautiful sounding record. Beautiful sounding. And I know it was done to, it wasn't done to tape, I think it was done digital, but, you know, it's just beautifully recorded. Drums are great. He's left bits in as well, bits of singing early on. You can hear him sort of just humming along with some Eric Clapton and stuff. And lovely bits of overlaid guitar, bits of clean stuff, and just beautifully produced. It sounds like After Midnight, off Clapton's first album, solo album, Eric Clapton, and which is another J.J. Cale song, but it's very, very similar, except that this is I think the recording on this is a lot better.
Now, you know, so we're talking about Eric Clapton, and I sometimes like to get a sense of these people, and, you know, you can talk about Eric and know, oh, everyone knows Eric Clapton. My question is for this one is, why did he choose to do this type of an album now, after all of his career with 18 Grammy Awards, Brit Award for Outstanding Music Contribution? He's got a CB from Lizzie Windsor. I mean, he's got Ivor Novello's coming out of every orifice. He's so successful, and he does that type of an album.
Well, it's going back to his roots from when he started as a solo performer, like I was saying, and I think also he wanted to do it all together, and I think that was recorded all together, which is our preferred way of doing things, as you know. And if you get the right musicians, the right studio, the right producer, and you got the time, which you do need time, because, you know, all these live recordings that were done by the Rolling Stones, sometimes they did 50 takes, even the band. They did like 50-odd takes, to get these things right, which is an enormous amount of takes, you know, and a lot of time. But it's worth it, I think, when you get that cohesive sound, you know.
What struck me as well was when we were recording all together is I realised more so than ever that I had to listen to everyone else.
Yeah.
That you have to know your part, and it becomes almost like breathing, that you don't have to think about necessarily what you're doing, and you're actually just conscious. Your consciousness goes to connect with everybody else. And I think that's where sometimes you have to maybe do it a few times to get that, to get to the band to a stage where you have that kind of magical moment, when some people call it like the fifth member, don't they, of the band, where it just becomes, the chemistry just ignites and you get that flame.
That's when it happens, you know?
Yeah.
And even if they're not great musicians, actually, even to some of the punk stuff where, you know, really they just picked up guitars in the garage and just went for it, the immediacy of that can sometimes work, you know, and it's just incredible.
And what's incredible, time's up.
No!
Yep, that's it for this week's episode of The Supertone Show. If you want to contact us, we're on Instagram, Starlight Campbell, Twitter, @SusieandSimon, and, of course, Facebook.
And the show's available on Mixcloud, Spotify, iTunes and iHeartRadio.
And please, join us again and tell your friends.